Members of my household have stumbled upon a couple of books that unexpectedly made their way from the bookshelves of my youth into theirs. And my guess is that these books might be familiar to a certain age bracket of readers that are here today. They are from a genre known as choose your own adventure. Yes. In this genre, you are forced to make a choice every few pages as to how the story is going to proceed. Let's just say that there's a pilot on a mission in deep space. Suddenly, on page 12, you, the pilot, realize that your spacecraft has engine problems. What do you do? Well, if you, the protagonist, decide to abandon your spaceship, turn to page 27 and read on. However, if you decide to repair your spaceship and keep flying, you instead turn to page 35. The book, you see, rests on the premise that there are always several possibilities before you, and each choice determines your next choice. A skilled reader is able to navigate these choices to a successful end. The rest of us, however, find that there are many perils that a protagonist can face depending on our choices. Or we learn to hold several pages in our hand at once, which enables us to retreat back through our decision tree to somehow make amends. In our gospel this week, it seems that we are indeed faced with a decision tree. It's an adventure of choice, one of interpretation, and it has decided effects on the adventures that follow. Our decision reads actually as a rather innocuous part. In our passage this morning, it comes at the end of verse 22. After the crowd has heard Jesus read from the scroll of Isaiah, they've heard his declaration that today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. They then wonder, is this Joseph's son? And so, this will serve as our point for exploration, for there are several ways to understand that question, is this not Joseph's son? And each decision we make colors the outcome that then follows. So here's path number one. Over the centuries, some scholars have seen the crowd's question as a compliment of sorts, as a response of communal pride to what has just happened. This path draws on the parts of our text that show that Jesus has done well. In last week's gospel, we are told that the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. He was speaking with such authority that he had their total and complete attention. And this week we hear that all spoke well of him. They were amazed at his gracious or his grace-filled words. So when I hear our story in this way, what I imagine our question to be is something like this. Well, would you hear that? That's Joseph's boy. How about that? The challenge with this path, though, is that the turn that Jesus then makes in our text is really hard to comprehend. Right? Why would he turn from their praise in such a harsh and unexpected way? So let's take a look at path number two. Now, for those who want, you can still keep your finger in path number one in case this one ends in disaster. So path number two, it's the same scene, but this time it's something that shifts in the group that's listening. Now, it's not so present in Luke's gospel, but in Matthew and Mark's versions, they lean more in this direction. They tell their readers that at this point, the crowd takes offense at Jesus. Even though the crowd was once very impressed with his words, they have a hard time hearing that this hometown boy who has returned with all this big city knowledge might be teaching them something. This path might sound a little bit more like, well, isn't this Joseph's son? This is the kid who got lost in Jerusalem, and Mary and Joseph had to hustle back to the temple to find him, right? This guy? Really? Now, going down this path, you can see that Jesus' responses make more sense, right? You get a sense that the rage of the crowd might have been building all the way along. But again, Luke's account doesn't really clearly lead in this direction. And so there's a third path, one that doesn't lead to praise or to criticism, but it is a path full of repercussion. This interpretation, voiced by Lucan scholar Robert Tannehill, relies on an understanding of the social obligations, the societal needs that existed in first century Palestine. In this culture, preference is supposed to be given to one's own people, your family, your kin, your village. These bonds are strong and they run deep. Anyone who's grown up in a part of the United States that has deep roots, like maybe Maine or Mississippi, you've likely at some point been asked, and so who are your people? Because your people is where your loyalty lies. So our question now might sound like, ah, Joseph's son, he's returned. Many great things have been taking place, I hear. I wonder what he'll do for us. Our question now is, again, not about praise or criticism, but it is loaded with expectation. And it's an expectation that may not be met as intended. Because Jesus' response is swift and it is pointed. To paraphrase, he says, I'm sure that you would quote me the proverb, doctor, cure yourself, or do the things here that we've heard that you've done for the folks in Capernaum. Now, along this path, he is answering from them an implicit demand. That's great that you offered those strangers what we have been waiting for, but Jesus, we are your people. And so is this really then is where the turn in the Gospel of Luke begins. And it's where we see why prophets are not accepted by their own people. Because what the people at Nazareth are asking Jesus to do is to give them and them alone God's liberation, God's release, God's jubilee that Jesus is proclaiming to all. And Jesus cannot do that. You see, prophets are not, they cannot be bound by what Tannehill calls in-group loyalties. What the people of Nazareth wanted was for the grace of God to stay right here with them. Can you hear their cry, their lament, their anger? We're the ones who raised him. We did all the work. Why don't we get to receive all the reward? He's ours. Prophets always remind us that this isn't how it works. And it's why we get this just outrageously inflammatory set of stories from Jesus next. Because of what Jesus then reminds the Nazarenes is about Elijah and the widow of Zarephath and Elisha and Naaman the Syrian. Now, if you don't have like instant recall of those stories, let's review. These are both stories about the presence of God being made manifest in outsiders, people from outside of the tightly drawn circle. In the first story, there's a famine, and it is all through the land. Everybody is hurting. But God sends Elijah to a foreign widow of an enemy. And Jesus is clear to point out that there were plenty of widows that were in Israel at the time. And yet she was found worthy. And then in the second story, there were many, many lepers in the time of the prophet Elisha, but it was Naaman, the general of the military of Syria, right? This is the very army that at the time is holding sway over Israel. It was Naaman who receives healing. So do you get a sense of what the people of Nazareth were expecting? That this wonderful news, this fulfillment would be known in them because he was theirs. Can you feel that? Can you get a sense in your very being of what that's like? And then can you see why Jesus, in hearing their reminder of just whose son he is, why he might then offer them proverbs in Scripture to remind them that God is not just to be found in one tribe or one language or one people or one nation. That the circle they were drawing was too confining. That this good news of release and of healing and of liberation could not possibly be constrained to just one family or one kin or one village. And do you now have a sense as to why they might be filled with rage? Enough rage to physically pick him up, to drive him out of the town, to lead him up to the brow of a hill, and to try and hurl him off. Can you imagine a group of people who would want God's goodness and mercy and liberty, who would yearn for it so much that they would seek to hold it close, to keep it tight, just in case there wasn't enough to go around? I can, because I have. If I'm being honest, I get the rage of the people of Nazareth. But I thought that this was just for me. I thought this was just for us. Does this ring true for you somewhere in the twists and the turns of life as you know it? And then can you imagine the implications right now, today, in this fair city, in this nation? Can you imagine the implications if someone were to say to their people that this goodness, this relief, this possibility, this freedom, that it's not just for you, that it's not just for us, that it's also for those people that you are jealous of, the people that you're angry with, the very people that you fear, that this, all of this is for them too. This is human. This is human. And friends, as challenging as it is to hear, what our gospel tells us today is that it's on the outside of the circle. It's in the form of the other. This is where the grace of God is reliably found. In our most defended moments, we pretend that we can keep our precious gift, whatever it is, our rights, our privileges, our nationality, our church, our sacraments. We can keep whatever this precious gift is. We can keep it locked up in a cabinet to be shared only a little bit at a time, as it is proper. Or just share it with the people that look like us, or that talk like us, or that dress like us, or that think like us. This happens even in a city that prides itself on tolerance. But when we live this way, friends, it is far too easy for our lives to simply be about us, solely about our needs, just about our comfort or safety or security, all within our tightly drawn circles. Friends, I actually do believe that when we tell this story, or any of these stories of Jesus, that we, when we hear them, we then make choices. Today, every day is the ever-present now, and each day we make a choice to follow one of several paths. And sometimes we choose a path that lies behind guarded gates and along high walls as an attempt to not hear or see or have to heart those around us. Other times, when we look around, we charge down a path of unrelenting anger. Anger because what we see as gifts being given undeservedly to others. Both of these paths inevitably lead to dead ends. And so we, as part of this Jesus movement, we must choose another path. So what I pray for every day, for the common life of this nation, for this faith-filled parish family, for each of us as we choose the adventure that daily awaits, is that we choose the path that leads outside of this circumscribed safety, the path that leads alongside the other, the path that winds its way to the throne of grace.